Welcome, everybody. Erev Tov, part two of the Torah in Motion series with Dr. Shapiro on the rise of Reform Judaism and the response, the traditional response of the rabbinate, the rise of Reform Judaism. Always fascinating. We're looking forward to another very interesting evening and a long series. And Bakasha, Dr. Mark, it's all yours.
Okay, thank you. I just want to be able to share my screen with you. Here we are. Because I had a couple of things. First, from last class, someone asked, the word Frank. She said in Shtisel, they use the word Frank. Does that have anything to do with Yaakov Frank? And I said it didn't. And I didn't want to get into the details of the word Frank because I wasn't sure at the time of its origin. But now I think I have it. I found Hillel Halkin has something in this website, Baal HaShon. It's very good. It's all about the Hebrew language words. So basically, Frank is used as a term of abuse for Sephardim of all sorts, Eastern Sephardim, Western Sephardim. And as it's explained here, the word comes from the word Franco. Originally was used to refer to people coming from Spain and the Balkans who were coming from the West, but then when the Ashkenazim came, they used the term for all Sephardim. Again, we use the term Sephardim to include Eastern as well. Also, a couple of people emailed me about this business of doing funerals, burying people on Yom Tov Sheni. In fact, someone in the comments last week mentioned that Breuers does it on Yom Tov Sheni in their hospital, in their cemetery in Clifton. I don't know how that works, because if the people are living in Washington Heights, they can't attend. The people who are doing the burial will be non-Jews, or even Jews could probably, they'd be allowed to, I believe, even drive their own car, certainly be driven there. But I just wanted to clarify, because I realize this when people are speaking to me, the fact that we don't do it, there's good reason for it, because both Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Soloveitchik say that in today's day and age, you should not do funerals on Yom Tov Sheni, even if you can walk there, because there's going to be people who drive there and it creates a problem. Now, what about Kavod HaMeis? Well, Rav Moshe says that it's not really an issue because we can keep the body, we can keep it on ice, and you don't have to worry about any decay. Because otherwise you could say, what, are we supposed to cancel bar mitzvahs? I'm sure there have been some people who said cancel it. I know for a fact there have been people who said, don't tell non-religious relatives the bris. Tell them the bris is not going to be on the eighth day, so they don't drive. Say that the baby has an issue, so it's going to be later. And then after Shabbos, you tell them, well, at the last minute, we on Shabbos, the Moel said we could do it or something, because there has been this concern. But as far as I know, there are no modern Orthodox or yeshivish, non-Hasidic, other than the Breuers community, that allows burials on Yom Tov Sheni. As I said, you can even do Yom Tov Rishon if the non-Jews do it. Now for the comments. Someone emailed me, Yehuda, commenting to Rabbi Kelman. He thinks that his memory played tricks with him here about Rav Moshe and the tefillin. Because if you look in Igros Moshe, unless he has an earlier tshuva where he says differently, volume 5, number 24, Rav Moshe does have an issue with, in theory, with people wearing tefillin and not wearing tefillin Chol Hamoed. But as he goes through the tshuva, he says that in today's day and age, though, it's not really an issue because in America, everyone, shuls have everyone of all sorts. And therefore, it's known that everyone does their own thing. And he doesn't see it as a problem. He says, Keva du yadua. He says that today everyone knows, so no one's going to get really offended, unlike a place where it wouldn't be that way. So I don't know, Rabbi Kelman, if you're referring to a different tshuva or just you didn't remember it 100%.
So if I may, since you're calling me, so no, I'm not. And if I am corrected, I stand corrected. But what I do recall is, first of all, Rav Moshe, he doesn't like it. He accepts it. But what I do recall the tshuva, what I did say, he does have a tshuva, like he can't say v'fi yisharim tit halal out loud in a nusach, you know, svart shul. I'm going to have to look up the exact tshuva.
It could be a different tshuva.
Like, It could be two different tshuva, and sometimes Ramosha does have two different tshuva, so I don't know. I will try to look it up. I was doing it, you know, came up based on memory, but it's clear he didn't like the idea of two tefillin. Just said, in America, what can we do if that's the case? But I appreciate those who are medaktik and look it up offer their haga'ot. Thank you very much.
Ramosha points out, when the Mishnah Berurah, the Lashon of the Mishnah Berurah is a nachon, it's not proper. So Ramosha says, doesn't say it's usser. So he says, but in a place where everyone puts on tefillin,
kind of like,
it
like
would be usser not to. Ramosha does say it would be usser. But it's
It's kind of like woman not putting on tefillin. You know, and the Shulchan Aruch says it's not usser. It says it's not a good idea. I don't think people would like it too much if women put on tefillin and say, well, it's not usser, which is you, as you know, that's what it says in Shulchan Aruch. It's mochim, but it's not usser, but we'll leave that for another time. Okay. Thanks.
Finally, the last thing, I looked up, I wanted to get where Sholem, he discusses basically in his book, The Messianic Idea of Judaism. That's where he gives his whole, theory around page 84 and 5 that, through Sabbateanism and Frankism, which led to this, which had all this antinomianism. He said this paved the way for Haskalah and reform. I didn't see, I thought he does say also that the fighting of the rabbis led to a general disrespect and anti-clericalism. If he doesn't say it, other historians definitely say it, but I do think he has it. Maybe it's in his articles. I have to look on, he has a lot of articles dealing with the Emden-Ivetz dispute, which really split, but could be. Okay, my friends, we got great stuff. We always have great stuff. So I'll get to the comments and questions later. If you recall, we ended last class with the issue of burial. The Duke said that you have to, the question was raised, do they have to bury immediately or not? Is this a Kabbalistic thing, a superstitious thing? The Duke was of Mecklenburg Schwerin was... influence to say that you have to bury, you can't bury immediately. You have to leave it for 3 days. And the Jewish community turned to Rav Yaakov Emden. If you recall, Rav Yaakov Emden wrote that absolutely we have to bury immediately. And then they also wrote to Mendelssohn, great Jewish leader of his time. And Mendelssohn has two letters. First, he writes to the Duke in German, and he agrees with Rav Yaakov Emden that delaying burial is in opposition to Jewish law. And this letter, though it has to be said, was sent for the sake of Jewish solidarity. You can't have a situation where two Jewish leaders are saying different things. But it didn't reflect Mendelssohn's true view. By the way, for those who want to see, here is the famous painting of Mendelssohn, famous picture of him. He wrote another letter, a Hebrew letter, to the Jewish community. And here he said that what the Duke said, not to bury immediately, give it a few days, is not against Jewish law. First of all, Mendelssohn calls attention to the few places, a few times when you're allowed. We all know you're allowed to postpone burial. Mendelssohn says that if the rabbis allowed burial to be postponed, let's say if a family member is coming in, things like that. He says, certainly, if there remains the slightest doubt that he may still be alive, you can't bury him. After all, it's a case of pikuach nefesh here. That's what the science of the time said. Today, we could say that science was nonsense, or now we can determine in a much better fashion if someone's alive or not, but that's what the science said. But Mendelssohn went further, and he said that the contemporary practice of immediate burial that we all do was actually in opposition to Jewish tradition. So I said that this is the first example of a reform in practice. But Mendelssohn's position is that this is not a reform. This is actually a chazir atar el yoshna, that this is bringing back the way it was and it should be. Because he says, what was the old Jewish practice? You put the body in caves or catacombs where you watch it for 3 days in order to see if there are any signs of life. Exactly what the Duke said to do. By the way, if we have our English people can comment on this. But it used to be the practice in the United Synagogue in England, and I'm not talking ancient history, I'm talking 20th century, that no burial took place until 48 hours after death for the same reason. So I'd like to know what the situation is today. So again, so what Mendelssohn is saying, his quote reform, it's always called a reform, but Mendelssohn saying it's not a reform, was that Jews should return to the old way of doing things. And as he writes very piously, that we should return to the way of our forefathers and not depart mi yamin u'smol, from right to left. So what is he referring to? Well, let me show you here. There is a tractate, one of these tractates, minor tractates, really post-Talmudic, and it's called, you see at the top here, Masachet Smachot. Now, Masachet Smachot, Simchas, it's actually, that's a euphemism. The official name, the real name is Evo Rabati, but we don't like to say a negative thing, you know, though, so instead we call it, instead of Havegos, Simchas. So, those of you who aren't psachim, you know, Or Arba Asar, Lashon Sagi Nahar. So what does it say? Chapter 8. Here you go. And this is, I mean, these sources are not authoritative like the Talmud, but if you don't have something in the Talmud, these are quasi-authoritative sources. You can certainly use them. They're significant sources in many areas of halacha. If we don't have source in Bavli or Yerushalmi, we'll use them. And it's definitely able to tell us what the traditional practice was. Look at chapter 8. Yotzin, this is after you bury someone, Yotzin lebeis hakfaros. We go out to the cemetery, ufokdin al hamesin ad gimel yomim, and we go and visit the dead for 3 days. Is actually a different gear, so even 30 days. We're not concerned that this is an idolatrous practice. We know that in the ancients would go out, the non-Jews, and do all sorts of pagan practices. And it's not Darche Amori. There was a case where they went out to someone and they found that he was alive. They thought he was dead, but he's really alive. Acher, there was another one, the holy, hey, Bonnie Vachachmes. And they went out, they found another person who they thought was dead, and he was alive. And lo and behold, he even had lots of children. Now, let me first say that a number of people who've written about this controversy misunderstand what we just saw in Masachas Smachos. It's not that they were placed in the catacombs for 3 days before burial in the ground. No, they were placed in these catacombs for the first year or so. In Talmudic times, you would have a second burial after the original burial. After about a year, the bones were gathered. It's called Likut Atzamos. And they were placed in these ossuaries, these small chests. And the laws of Avelos were actually practiced on the day of the final interment. So, it's just that they would go out for 3 days, if we don't adopt the other version, 30 days, because they recognize that although we think someone's dead, he maybe is still alive. So this, how could you argue with it says in Masechus Machos? Here already we see that there is a concern that people could still be alive for 3 days. And we can't bury people, let's say in a catacomb, and then go visit them because we don't have that. We just bury them in the ground for the reason we'll see in a minute. So therefore, in our circumstances, Mendelssohn said we have to follow the old practice, namely be concerned. You have to be worried. Choshishin, that maybe the person's still alive. If they were concerned about this in the days of Masechus Machos, certainly we need to be concerned about it today. Well, Rav Yaakov Emden writes to Mendelssohn, and he completely rejects what Mendelssohn said. It's a good proof. I mean, if they did in the days of ancient, and this means if they did in Smachos, that means they did in the days of Chazal. I mean, they're just the continuation of what was being done. Emden rejects Mendelssohn's point, and he writes to him as follows. First of all, he says, God forbid that we do such a thing. He says, we can't question the practice, the minhag of our forefathers, and he says this is a universal minhag. This isn't like Ashkenazim and Sephardim do it differently. Everyone does it the same. He says everyone from the far east to the west, they all do the exact same thing. He says it's never been heard of in any Jewish community today that they should practice any other practice other than immediate burial. And he says today, even in Eretz Yisrael, they do immediate burial. And he says, God forbid that we entertain any doubts about this. that you're going to tell us, Mendelssohn, that all the Jews, all the Ashkenazic and Sephardic Jews, for as long as we can remember, in all their lands who've been burying immediately, they all have it wrong? He says, you can't say that. So he says, so what's going on then? What's Maseches Machos talking about? What's the catacombs or the caves? He says, first of all, we don't do it. Why don't we do it? Because we're living in Europe here. We don't have caves and catacombs, although they have it in Rome, by the way. If you go to Rome, you can go visit the catacombs, and a lot of people do it. It's part of the standard tour, although we don't do that on our tour. But you can come the day before, and you can go visit the catacombs. I highly recommend it. But there are Jewish catacombs also. But they're only open a few days a year. You have to make private arrangements for that. And you can see they have Jewish imagery down there as well. But generally, he said, we don't do that. I don't know if Aquaventin knew about the Rome Jews. And when I say the Rome Jews, I don't mean the last 500 years. We're talking way, way before that. He says, we have no caves. We have no catacombs. So in Israel, they had this, so they could do that. And that's why it became the custom. In Israel, they did it one way, but outside of Israel, they did it another way. So we don't have this. So it's a choice between leaving the body out. Remember, they couldn't refrigerate it like we could today. You're going to leave the body out. You're going to bury it. He says that's the reason why everyone buries it, because this is such a far-fetched thing. When you bury it in a catacomb, it's no big deal. You can go look. But if it's a choice between leaving the body out where it can decay, or immediate burial, he says, Minhag Yisrael, universal, is you bury it immediately. Now, what about Pikuach Nefesh? That's what Mendelssohn said. When it comes to Pikuach Nefesh, saving life, we bend over backwards. We do all sorts of extreme stuff because maybe it could save someone's life. And Rav Yaakov Emden says as follows. We are not concerned with remote possibilities and with the minutest minimum in any matter. That is, we don't take into account such far-fetched possibilities. And that's how we live, too. We have in America, I don't know Canada, in America, like 50,000 people a year are killed in car crashes. Pete Buttigieg says he wants to get it down to nothing. Like, I don't know what, you know what? I could get it down to nothing. I could get zero deaths of cars in a year. You know how I could do that? Change the speed limit to 15 miles an hour. I guarantee you no one's going to die car crash, or we'll keep it down to under 10. The whole country. So now if Pikuach Nefesh is the most important thing, human life is the most important thing, everyone should jump on the bandwagon. 15 mile an hour, 10 mile an hour speed limit, right? Well, the answer is no. Because at the end of the day, every time we leave our house, we take a certain amount of risk. And we've decided that... for life to function in any sort of normal way in modern times, that we have to drive, we have to fly on airplanes. You could ban airplanes and say that a plane might go down, but we have to take a certain amount of risk. And the halachic system, Rav Yaakov Emden is saying, recognizes a certain amount of risk. We can't go for these far out cases that once every 10 years or 100 years, you're going to find someone who you thought was dead and he's really alive. We're not concerned about it. If it was once every 10 years, maybe it would be a miyachah. It's a miyachah in a much of it. Maybe you take into account. But these are like far-fetched cases that you read in the New York Post on Saturday. They have the section there, strange but true. But not like, you know, not normal happenings. But I would be interested to know how Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, the great Reb Chaim, would respond to this. At least according to Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, and who am I to disagree with Rav Aaron, but I find this very unlikely. But Rav Aaron said it, or at least he's quoted by Rav Nasan Kamenetsky, that Rav Chaim said that even a millionth of a doubt of danger to life obligates the stringency of eating on Yom Kippur. That is, when you eat on Yom Kippur, it's not that you're being mako, you're being machmer, on pikuach nefesh. Even a millionth? I don't know what that means. How do you quantify a million? But that's what he said. In fact, the story is told as follows about Reb Chaim. This is in the family. A Jew came to Reb Chaim on Friday evening to ask if he is permitted to travel on Shabbos to the city where his son was about to be brought up before the draft board. On the chance, the far-fetched chance, you might say, that the father would be able to get him exempted. And Reb Chaim allowed the father to travel Friday night, violate Shabbos, to go to the city where his son is going to be brought before the draft board. Why? How could he do this? Reb Chaim was asked. And he said, the people questioned this ruling. Reb Chaim said, if the young man is drafted, he's going to have to serve 5 years. And during these 5 years, maybe a war will break out. And if a war breaks out, maybe he's going to be sent to the front lines and he might be killed. So it's a matter of pikuach nefesh. It overrides the Shabbos. But, I mean, that's not a millionth of a chance. But if you want to know more from Rav Aharon, let me show you something. I have this book, Yeled Sha'ashuim. There's a picture of Aharon as a young man. And it's published by his son, Rav Yosef Soloveitchik. And it has some good stories about the briskers and pikuach nefesh. If you turn to page 325, it says as follows. An example of a psak of Rav Aharon, which ran contrary to the ideas of some rabbanim in the new generation of the yeshiva shevelt. He says that he's going to give us a psak of Rav Aharon, which is against the ideas of the rabbanim in the new generation of the yeshiva world. Now, that's the touched-up version. The original version appears in this volume. Here, I bound it. But it's an earlier version, which only certain people are privileged to have the copy of. This is the language that he used. An example of a psak Rav Aharon, which some so-called Talmidei Chachamim in the yeshiva shevelt would out of jealousy speak disparagingly of Rav Aharon, is the psak that one must be Mechal Shabbos to even save the life of a Mumar Achis. That is, he's just a little sharper in this. Rav Aharon writes, says that even for a someone who is not just a sinner, but a heretic, not just the average person doesn't know any better, one who's given it all up intentionally. And it's the famous story, which he quotes here in this book, which is quoted other places, how Reb Chaim stopped the davening on Yom Kippur to raise money to ransom. They're going to send this Jewish communist. Now, you know what a Jewish communist is? These were the anti-religious. These are the ones who, after the revolution, persecuted all the Jews. Reb Chana Wasserman refers to them as Amalek, the seed of Amalek, the Jewish communists. I don't know how to pronounce it, Yevetzkias. But Reb Chaim, they needed 5,000 rubles, is the figure they give, to stop them from being exiled to Siberia, or where, you know, he could die out there in the cold. But the people didn't want to give. In fact, many of them thought of the Arta Harami Kirbecha. This is a way of getting rid of this troublemaker, because these communists cause all sorts of problems. The Jews just wanted to be quiet and get along, and the Tsar would tolerate them. And here you have these Jewish revolutionaries creating all these problems. And you know, after the attempt on the Tsar's life in the end of the 19th century, was the Tsar Alexander. Which then launched all the pogroms. There were some Jews who had tangential involvement, but they blamed the Jews. So these people were troublemakers. But Reb Chaim said, absolutely not. He refused to allow Yom Kippur davening to go on. He says, you can all stay at home. We're not going to have davening unless the money is raised. And then Rav Aharon, on page 326, tells the story of, I gave this story a few semesters ago, of his in Washington Heights. You know, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik was in Washington Heights. He lived there when he was teaching at YU. Yeshiva Sefer Tzachon, and it wasn't YU then, it was Yeshiva College. But he tells about in Beis Medrash HaGadol in Washington Heights. I don't know who the rabbi of Beis Medrash HaGadol was now, but the rabbi then was Rosh Shachatovitz. And he speaks about a guy named Benny Gordon, who's the son of if there's still Beis Medrash HaGadol, he's the son of Mr. Gordon, who was the gabbai. And he was involved, I guess he was in the Jewish mob. You know, Murder Incorporated sign, but he didn't do the murder. It was felony murder. He drove the getaway car when he killed someone, and he was sentenced to death. And Rav Moshe Soloveitchik told the rabbi of the shul, he wanted to, the gabbai wanted Rav Shachatovitz to go to Albany and plead for his son's life. And Rosh Chodesh said, on Yom Tov, Rosh Chodesh says, how can I go? This must be when I lived in the Upper West Side, there was a Rabbi Shachatovitz. He was the rabbi of West Side Institutional. I guess that's his father, Rabbi Mordechai Shachatovitz, I think it was. I know he was involved in the Gudas Rabbanim. And Rosh Chodesh says, how can I drive on Yom Tov? And they went to Rav Moshe, and Rav Moshe says, absolutely, get in a car and drive there. So Rosh Chodesh took a car and drove to Albany. And then they tell the story that Governor Lehman commuted his sentence to life in prison. And I don't know if it had anything to do with Rosh Chodesh driving up there, but the sentence was commuted. But Ramosha Soloveitchik's point was that if you have a possibility of going there and speaking to a legislator, getting into perhaps see the governor, and as the clergyman, as you can, the rabbi of the unfortunate, you can maybe make a claim that he didn't know any better, that you have to do it. And that's what they say. He was released to life imprisonment. And then it says he got out later on parole. He was, I guess, a congregant. If you go to the Jewish Center on the Upper West Side, you will see there on the wall there the name of one of the machers named Rothstein on the wall of the Jewish Center. Now, that just happens to be the father of, what's his name, Arnie Rothstein, right? The man who fixed the world, the White Sox, the Black Sox scandal. The Jewish gangster, Mortar Incorporated, did he get the electric chair or was he rubbed out? I forget now. But I remember when I looked through the Leo, you know who gave his hesped for this gangster, Arnie Rothstein? None other than Rabbi Leo Young.
He got the electric chair.
He got the electric chair. Okay. So someone said rub that. He got the electric chair. Thank you. So I went through all of Rabbi Leo Young's archives, and they're at YU now. And in there, there's a letter. I should have made a copy of it. Next time I'm there, I'll make a copy, in which a congregant wrote protesting, how could Rabbi Young do the funeral, which he obviously must have given a hesped also, for this gangster. My grandmother, by the way, in Brownsville, she grew up with some of these gangster types. She had all sorts of stories. They kept the neighborhood safe. Let's put it that way. And Rabbi Young's, the letter, there's no letter to Rabbi Young there. What you have in the archive is a copy of Rabbi Young's letter to the person, and which he justifies it, saying that, I forget exactly what he says, that, everyone has certain good qualities, whatever he says, that, you focus on the good qualities. Even a gangster could have, like Esav had, he respected his parents. So you speak on the Kibbutz Av Ha'Em, everyone knows the problems. Look, in the Jewish Link 2 weeks ago, there was a hesped, a very, very long hesped, of a politician in New York who recently passed away. And if you look in the last issue of the Jewish Link, you have two letters to the editor. I'm surprised they printed it, quite strong, saying that we don't need to, we don't need to turn people who've made Chil Hashem into tzaddikim. It's enough just to mention that they did a good thing, but not to turn them into tzaddikim. You can see in last week's Jewish Link, I don't need to go into any more details. And the issue here is not just the corruption. There's other things. But so that's what Rav Aharon tells us. By the way, there's one more thing about from Rav Aharon. Just to tell you, because I know you love this sort of stuff, the stuff that you don't get anywhere else. Rav Aharon has two more stories, which he does not include in Yevod Shah Shui. Right after he tells the story of Rav Shochatovitz, he tells about the wedding of Shmuel Soloveitchik, that's the brother of Rav Aharon, that took place in Atlantic City in the early 1950s, and how all the guests came on a bus that was provided. And during the trip to Atlantic City, Rebbetzin Lifsha Feinstein, that's the daughter of the Brisker Rav, the wife of Yechiel Micha Feinstein, who worked for the Rav. He taught in Boston at the Rav opened this yeshiva in Boston called Yeshivas Hechel Rabbeinu Chaim Halevi. She began to provoke Rav Yosha Ber over his support for Medinas Yisrael. Rav Yosha Ber said to her, but we see that Medinas Yisrael, the state of Israel, has siyata d'shamayah, the help of heaven. She answered, we have not yet seen the end. Rebbetzin Pesha Soloveitchik. Rav Aharon's mother was very disturbed over this answer of Rebbetzin Lifsha. Rebbetzin Pesha had in general a positive view of her niece, Rebbetzin Lifsha Feinstein. But this response of Rebbetzin Lifsha Feinstein shocked her because this was real sinas Yisrael. Rav Aharon's son visited one of Rav Aharon's cousins in Yerushalayim. In Tishrei of Toshin Men Gimel, Rav Aharon's cousin, this is the Briskers in Israel, in discussing the military presence in Israel and Lebanon, laughed at the difficulties that the Israeli army was having in Lebanon. Rav Aharon's son was shocked by this display of Sinas Yisrael. So, and then he continues that Rebbetzin Pesha said, the Rav Chaim was a kanoi but his kanos never interfered with his avas Yisrael. And therefore, because of his love of Israel, even the Jewish communists held Reb Chaim in great esteem. And finally, this is the last thing I'll read. We asked the multitudes of so-called kanaim in Brisk and the yeshiva welt who speak in the name of Reb Chaim, where is your avas Yisrael? How can you not be concerned over the fact that through your so-called kanos, you side Rachmano Etzlan into the negativity of real sinas Yisrael? Now, for whatever reason, Rabbi Yosef Soloveitchik, when he published the Yelad Shashuim, he chose to omit these harsh criticisms of his of these kanaim. Incidentally, as long as we're speaking about army and things like that, I mean, saving of life, you should know that on page 266, you have something else as well. I don't know if any of you know Irv Ruderman. I spent Pesach with him about 7-8 years ago. Irv Ruderman was a conscientious objector. He didn't want to go to Vietnam. Now, he's not a Quaker. He's not a pacifist. He believed in fighting, but he thought that Vietnam was an immoral war. And you have here Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was a lawyer also. His letter, his three-page letter to the draft board, which was not successful, but three-page letter to the draft board arguing that Irving Ruderman is indeed a conscientious objector. And he takes up there was a Supreme Court decision that held that this Catholic, Leslie Charles Bowen, he was found to be a valid conscientious objector, even though he wasn't opposed to all wars, only unjust wars. And what's really interesting, and I don't know if Rav Aaron just wrote this to the court. Look, Rav Aaron's a very ethical person. He wouldn't say something if he didn't believe it, even to the court. He wasn't one of these people like the Mendelssohnians. You say one thing to the court, another thing to your people. But because in this, he says, because he's responding to the fact that the rabbis support the Vietnam War. Well, that's the truth. If you looked around, the rabbis, it's not that they supported the Vietnam War, but they supported, they always supported the president. Whatever the presidents want, they support. And he says, first of all, he doesn't say that all the rabbis support it, but then he says, according to Orthodox Jewish faith, each Orthodox Jew with a moderate background in religious doctrine is to determine for himself on the basis of a delving in ecclesiastical sources, all questions in regard to his relationship with fellow men. Today, there is no rabbi or rabbinic organization with absolute religious authority. Then he says the absolute religious authority is in the Bible and the Talmud. So what he's telling the court is that Irv Ruderman has the ability on his own to investigate the Jewish sources. And if he concludes that it's immoral, the war is immoral, then he can be a conscientious objector. And no one can say that Irv Ruderman can't make his own decision because there is no Das Torah. That's what he says. Everyone can, on their own, in matters such as this, can determine themselves what they see as the proper course. So there you have it. Returning to our story. By the way, there are many examples. Reb Chaim, you all know, I mean, you all heard the story, or I hope you have. I've said it many times. Reb Chaim, when he was challenged, how was he so lenient about Yom Kippur? He says, not that he's lenient Yom Kippur, he's strict with Pikuach Nefesh. But let me give you an example of a case that'll blow you away. You had the Hasidim, and they came up with all sorts of heterim. If someone's ill, you could travel on Shabbos to the tzaddik to ask him to pray for you. You could send a telegram on Shabbos because the Rebbe, the tzaddik, if he doesn't know to pray for you. So if you travel on Shabbos, or if you send him a telegram, today, I guess you can call him on the phone, that then he can include you in the prayers, and that's Pikuach Nefesh. Or Shlomo Kluger went crazy about this. He says, absolutely not. You don't violate Shabbos for Pikuach Nefesh if it's not a natural thing. And this goes back to the Rambam. You can't come up with some thing, well, you know, I'll write a Kameya. There were those who thought you could write. So you can write a Kameya, write an amulet, because that's going to cure you. Well, I hope you're sitting down. And this is quoted by Rav Schachter in Nefesh HaRab, but we have it elsewhere as well. Reb Chaim held that it's permissible to send a telegram on Shabbos to a tzaddik so he could pray for someone who's very ill. And he thought that, unlike Rav Shlomo Kluger and everyone else, basically, he thought this fell into the category of least questionable Pikuach Nefesh. So the question is, what does it mean, Pikuach Nefesh, there? There's two possibilities. One is that, you know, well, it is unlikely, but you never know. The tzaddik, maybe his prayers will be answered. But there's a simpler way to deal with this, and that's the psychosomatic. The Rambam says that although he doesn't say this about, he says it has to be natural cure, but he says, for instance, that you can recite incantations. Even don't worry about Avodah Zarah, even on Shabbos you can, it's not an issue. Even though he says it doesn't work medically, nevertheless, it calms the person. So then people's psychology is very important in terms of healing. So Reb Chaim, I don't know whether he believed that it's at least a safek bikuach nefesh, because maybe the tzaddik's prayer will be answered, or no, the person. If I know that the telegram has been sent and the tzaddik is going to pray for me, that's going to calm me. And that's going to make me feel better. And that is pikuach. That, at least that is definitely a question of pikuach nefesh, because if you tell the person who's on death's door that we can't violate Shabbos for you, then he'll give up hope. He could die right there if you say we're sending a telegram. Now you could say, well, maybe don't send a telegram. Just tell the person you're sending a telegram. So I don't know. You'd have to ask, maybe Reb Chaim would say, well, you can't do that because he might find out or anything. I don't know the reason, but, and it certainly makes sense to me, though, the idea that if the person at least thinks you're sending a telegram or knows you're sending a telegram, it's going to make him feel better. This is not a, I don't know if it's my chiddush, but when I wrote about this once, I said that the Rambam's position that you're not allowed to violate any Jewish laws for cures that are not natural. Like, you can't tell someone he could eat non-kosher food because it has magical capabilities. This is only found in the commentary in the Mishnah. It's not found in the Mishnah Torah. So I think maybe for Reb Chaim, that would be significant that he leaves this out in the Mishnah Torah. So maybe there. Okay, returning to our story. As for Mendelssohn, and what Mendelssohn's position. Well, one more thing about from Emden. So Rakim Emden says to Mendelssohn, quote, when it comes to the doctors today tell us we have to do this or that. He says, we don't pay any attention to them when it comes to matters relating to Jewish law. That is, we listen to doctors when Jewish law tells us to. If you want to know if you have to eat on Yom Kippur, you go to the doctors. You don't go to the rabbi. You go to the doctors. However, here we know what the halacha is. You have to bury immediately. So we don't listen to the rabbis telling us something else, just like you won't listen to them with mitzitza or all these sorts of things. My thought experiment, if you take like the modern Orthodox mindset and you put it back, let's say 200 years ago, here you have the medicine at the time telling you this is an actual sakana, and you don't need to be modern Orthodox to put Reb Chaim back there. Wouldn't the modern Orthodox, wouldn't Reb Chaim agree with Mendelssohn? You're going to go with the doctors, or you're going to go with our tradition. Fine, that was the tradition, but now the doctors, you can come up with all sorts of justifications. You could say that nishtana teva. It used to be people died immediately, but now our natures have changed. We're weaker, whatever it is, or we're stronger. We hold on longer. We've done that in many cases. We violate Shabbos now in the 8th month to save a baby, even though according to halacha, you weren't supposed to. So I have no doubt that the modern Orthodox type of thinking, and not just the modern Orthodox, would agree with Mendelssohn that, and this is a reform, granted, it's a reform with a small r, but that's in accord with what was viewed, even if it's incorrect, and maybe it wasn't incorrect, because they didn't have maybe the best ways of identifying if you're really dead. I don't know. But this is always seen as a reform. In fact, the first examples of reform before the reform movement, and as I said, Mendelssohn doesn't see it as reform, but this strikes me as reform with a small r, because you could definitely make a halachic case that if the doctors today say this is what we have to do, how is this different than saving a baby on violent Shabbos in the 8th month or any number of things that we do? Okay, let us go further. In the end of the 18th century, you know, the Mendelssohnian era, we don't have a reform movement. But we do have a Haskalah, the Enlightenment, which attracted intellectuals who wanted to bring about changes in Jewish life, changes in education, in religious practices. They wanted assimilation in language, of course, and manners. They wanted a revised curriculum. They wanted Jews to feel loyalty to the modern state. Clearly, they wanted changes in religious practice, but they didn't get involved with that. That wasn't really their issue. They were focused on other things. for many of them, like Mendelssohn and Naftali Hartwig, Vesely Weisel, they were completely observant Jews. But and the practices they would, you know, get rid of, like I said, you can get rid of the Kupurkan, maybe get rid of some Yotzroses. We're not talking about any significant changes. But there was one Maskil who I firmly believe is a proto-reformer, for he was operating, at least in his public persona, as a traditional Jew. And I see him as a reformer. In addition, he uses rabbinic literature to argue for reform, even perhaps radical reform. And who do I refer to? Who do I have in mind? None other than Rav Shaul Berlin. His dates are 1740 to 1794. The son of the rabbi of Berlin. That's why his name is Berlin. Herschel Levin, Rav Tzvi Herschel Levin. In his day, he was a leading rabbi. Today, he's basically all forgotten. So much forgotten that the great Rabbi J. David Bleich, in speaking about him, because he was before that, he was a rabbi in London, and he gave some important rulings on kashrus matters, and it's recorded in the literature. His name was Hart Lion. That's how he was called in London. Hart Tzvi. L-Y-O-N, they call it Hart Lion. Tzvi Hirsch Levin. So Lion is Levin. Rabbi Bleich doesn't know who Hart Lion is. He terms him like someone called Hart Lion. Hart Lion is none other than Harav HaGaon Ritzvi Hirsch Levin. Now, I want to talk about this Rav Shaul Berlin and his contributions and what he said. And as I mentioned, I see him as a reformer. And I've mentioned this before, but I point out again that those who are interested, Rabbi Rakefet has, I think it's like 10 classes online. I heard a number of them. I listen on my drive to Scranton. I've been listening now, all the great Torah in Motion stuff, the new semesters. I'm going to get to Bill Gewurz. I've already heard a number of others. I heard the talks on Jews and introductions to Islam for Jews. There's so much great stuff going on, but I drive there and back only twice a week, and it's an hour and about 35 minutes. So, but if I go to YouTube, that way I speed it up. So I get a lot more, but, I listened to Rabbi Rakefet, and Rabbi Rakefet has this approach that Shaul Berlin is basically a YU person. But since at the end of the 18th century, there wasn't YU, therefore he has to live outwardly as a traditionalist. But secretly, he's trying to create like a YU Torah Umada type of Judaism. I think that is a complete mistake, a complete inversion. And after you see a few of the tshuvot I mentioned, I don't think you're going to – it's actually this is the sort of thing that the Satmar will say about YU people, because they view YU people as no different than reformers. But when you see what he says, I don't think anyone associated with YU would want to claim him. And I'm a little surprised, to put it mildly, that Rabbi Rakefet wanted to. In other words, he wasn't a modern Orthodox Jew. He was a proto-reformer. Now, he came from an important rabbinic family. They all came from big group. And these families, there was one rabbinic culture. And it didn't matter whether you were in England or Poland and Germany. They all spoke the same language, Yiddish. They all were related to each other in marriage. All these people are related. They all, their children marry each other. If you're a rabbi, either your children marry other rabbis or they marry rich people. That was the group they had there, the way they intermarried with each other. His brother was named Solomon Herschel. Shlomo Hirsch. He was the rabbi of London. He was, they call him, the first chief rabbi of England. Now, Shaul Berlin was a great Talmudist, really a great Talmudist. He was a rav in Frankfurt am Oder. You have Frankfurt am Main, and you have the lesser Frankfurt. But he fell in with the Maskilim. And a lot of the people who write about Shaul Berlin in the traditional world, they only deal with the Sefer we're going to look at, but they don't know about his history. They don't, if they knew about his history and how he was involved with the Maskilim and was writing for the Maskilim, they wouldn't feel the need to defend him. But he fell into with the Maskilim. Around 1780, he leaves the rabbinate and he settles in Berlin, where he joins a Haskalah group. He actually writes an approbation, Haskama, to Mendelssohn's Biur. He also wrote a satire in defense of Wesley, who wanted to, called Ktav Yosher. He wanted to modernize Jewish education. And in this work, he criticizes the methods of education, scholarship, customs, and superstitions of the day. So that's very Haskalah, but it's not really reformist, because I'm using the word reform to talk about reform in religious life. He also wrote a book anonymously called Mitzpeh Yachta'el, which consists of harsh criticisms of the Rav of Rabbi Rafal HaKohen. He wrote a book called Torah Sukkosio, and he was one of the leading scholars of the day. He was rabbi of what they call the triple community. In Hebrew, we know it as Ahu, Aleph, Hey, Vav. Ahu is Altona, Hey is Hamburg, and Vav is Wandsbek. For a time, it was controlled by Denmark. If you go today, Altona is, it's part of Hamburg. It used to be a suburb, but now it's in one city. And why would you go there? There's one reason why I went there. Well, first I thought one day we will, maybe. I wanted to do a tour of, and we'll go up. We did Germany, but we did other areas, the north. But if you want to see, for example, the cemetery, Yaakov Emden, Rav Yonos and Leibschitz, and also Hamburg is a fascinating city from the standpoint of Jewish history. So there's a lot to see there. So Rav Shaul Berlin publishes his work anonymously, and because it's disrespectful, not just in terms of the scholarship of Rafal, it accuses him of corruption, it accuses him of plagiarism. The author of it was put in Cheirim. Problem is, the author was anonymous, so they didn't know who, they're putting the person in Cheirim who they don't know. In fact, Rav Shaul Berlin's own father, Tzvi Hirsch, signs the Cheirim against the anonymous person. So I guess it's sort of symbolic. But then it becomes known who the author was. And then Tzvi Hirsch Levin, the Rav of Berlin, backtracks to protect his son. He will always, to the end, protect his son, even as any good father should do, I guess, even when it became apparent who his son was. And right in the midst of this controversy of the attack on Rafal, while his father was protecting him, lo and behold, another of the books of Shaul Berlin appears. And that's in 1793, and a new controversy begins, and that's a book called Besamim Rosh. Now, this book, Rosh, because many of the tshuvot are from the Rosh, Rosh Rabin Yechiel, or say it to be Brother Rosh, although many other Rishonim as well, and anonymous. And Besamim, because, that's a phrase, Besamim Rosh, but also it equals 392. I can't help thinking that... first they write the 392, and then he comes up with the name. But this work, fortunately, was recently reprinted. Anyone can buy it here. This is Mizrahi's site. They reprinted it, the 1984 edition, which in and of itself we're going to have to talk about, because here you have a big Talmud Chacham in Israel who thinks Rav Shaul Berlin is one of the Gedolei Yisrael and Tzadiki Hador, and he republishes it with his notes. But it's a very helpful edition because the notes are very interesting. So if you want your own copy of the Besamim Rosh, of the original edition, the original printing from 1793, you can get it here from Mizrahi. Now, the title page of the book, here it is. It says these works of Rishonim, they're from Rush and other Rishonim. Someone from the days of the Beit Yosef, his name is Yitzhak Di Molina, he collected them and brought them all together. And then it would be published, the whole story of how Shaul Berlin bought this manuscript. Who is Yitzhak Di Molina? Well, he's a nobody, but he's mentioned in the Tshuvas of the Beis Yosef. So Shaul Berlin, to try to create this story, he saw this name in the Beit Yosef, so he uses this as his figure, as the one who gathered it, who collected it. And now Shaul Berlin is publishing him, as he says, with his own commentary, the Kasa D'Harsana, Ani Hatzair Shaul Ben, the son of my father, Tzvi Hirsch, the Av Beistin, here in Berlin. By the way, it's published by Chevras, the Education of Children, Chinuch Narim Society, which was the Yushin Freischule, which was associated with Maskilim. And the book is published with an approbation, a haskama of course, his father, and the Nota Yehuda, the great letter from the Nota Yehuda. Already in the introduction to this book, we see something of interest, because he has a hakdama, and he talks a little bit about hakdamot, the genre of introductions. And he says that there's no hakdama to the Talmud, there's no hakdama, you don't have to Midrash, you don't have hakdama to the Yerushalmi, the Bavli, but you know where you have a hakdama to? You have a hakdama, an introduction to the Zohar. So he says in the introduction, well, in this I'm like my uncle, Rav Yaakov Emden. And he just leaves it at that. You have to know, Rav Yaakov Emden said, of course, that the Zohar was a medieval work. But so here you have already in the introduction, Shaul Berlin saying that identifying himself as not a Zohar, is not the authenticity of the Zohar. Now, anytime you publish new writings of the Rush and other Rishonim, today, of course, these things are published all the time. You have Machon Yerushalayim, Masadar of Cook, and many, many others, Mechitzei Yudamim, but this is quite unusual in the 18th century to publish from Rishonim. So this has become a bestseller. So everyone bought the Besamim Rosh. However, it soon became apparent that there are a number of strange responsa in the book, which couldn't have been written by any Rishon, including at least one responsa, if not more, which we are going to see the entire program of reform. But the reform of like 30 years after Shaul Berlin is found by the Rush. The Rush himself is a reformer telling you everything to the extent that you don't even have to observe the Torah. How could the Rush say that? Well, you shall see. And I don't think we're going to get to next. We'll get to next class. Well, as soon as people started studying the book and seeing the strange stuff in there, and I have a project right now. Every time I'm on my bicycle, I'm doing exercise, I try to go through one tshuva. I am going through every single tshuva. I don't know if anyone's ever done this. I have found what I think to be unusual and just hints to the forgery in all sorts of responsa that no one has ever dealt with. Most of the responsa are just run-of-the-mill. So you have certain people who say that what Shaul Berlin did is he has authentic medieval responsa, and then he inserts all these other responses. Is it 10? Is it 20? Is it more in there to cover his tracks? And he covers his tracks with the authentic ones, and he puts the heretical ones, the reformist ones in there. I don't think so. There's no evidence that any of these are authentic. And I'll try to show that if I ever get around to writing my article on this. I think that Rav Shaul Berlin, the genius of genius, he creates all these responsa. And then to make it like it's that 95% are just run of the mill. And then he does that to create the cover to stick in his heretical, his reformist responsa. And I'll show you that even when we'll get to the next class, even when he's machmir, he's a reformer, a proto reformer, we can call it. So when this, they start reading it, all of a sudden the Gedolim and the Talmudists say, no, this can't be from a Rishon, and a huge dispute breaks out, and a giant campaign begins, launched by the rabbis, proclaiming Shaul Berlin as a heretic. They didn't call him a reformer because they didn't have the word reformer yet. It's not part of their lexicon, but that's what they're calling him. They're calling him a heretic. They're calling him one who wants to uproot Judaism. The same things we're going to see with the reformers. And he is a reformer in certain ways, at least in a couple of the responsa, and others, he just is a heretic. But in a couple of them, he's, I don't know if he's an atheist or anything like that, because then why would he spend the time to try to create a reformist tshuva? It's enough to just be a heretic, but, and who's left alone to support him? His father in that lonely, his father is defending him and, the authority of the manuscript. And as is always the case, he can't come up with the manuscript. These forgers can never come up with the manuscript because they create the manuscript. So when they're asked to produce it, they can never produce it. Again and again, we see this. What we're going to do, I see it's already almost time. What we're going to do next class, I'll speak a little bit more about the religious politics. By the way, one of you emailed me, should I speak about Rav Eliezer Melamed? You know, they're trying to do the same thing to Rav Eliezer Melamed that they did to Shaul Berlin. The difference is that Rav Eliezer Melamed is a Gadol B'Yisrael, He sold 1,000 books of halacha, the most popular halachic work in our day. Not only that, the most popular halachic work ever in history, probably in one generation. Yes, the Shulchan Aruch is more than 1 million sold, but in one generation, never. They want to destroy him mostly because he's too liberal on he talks to reform and things like that. He does apparently have certain big kulot in Nida matters, but okay, that's he's a bar haki, as they say. And so if you're following the news, that's nothing like Rav Shaul Berlin. No comparison here. Rav Shaul Berlin is a completely different case. And then I'm going to show you three or four responsa, and you can then decide whether you agree with me. Are these reform? I think you'll agree they're heretical, but are these reformist also? Because I view him as a proto-reformer, the first, really, reformer, Shaul Berlin. Believe it or not, in Michael Myers' book, he mentions him also. He only has like one or two paragraphs on him, but he throws it out. I think you got to give Shaul Berlin more space. And then I'll tell you what happened to him. I found his grave in London. I mean, it was there, but I got, it's not like it's hidden where I discovered it, but, I'll tell you the whole story next week. So we have a lot to do still. Let me make a mark here. Let me take the comments and the questions here. Thank you all for coming out tonight. You're going to see me perhaps if you want this Wednesday, although it might be hard live. But because the people in Morocco and Europe are in a different time zone, I'll be doing it at 2. Rabbi Kelman will speak about it at the end. But let's see. Judah says Frank is a derogatory term for Sephardim. Yeah, what happened is that originally was used just as a term for the Jews from Spain and the Balkans. Then the Ashkenazim came to the land of Israel, and they started calling all the Sephardim that, and it became a derogatory term. Why it became derogatory? That isn't really explained, other than the fact that the Ashkenazim felt like they were superior. So therefore, if they call them Franks, then it's derogatory. Now, Danny says that he remembers his grandmother's burial on Yom Tov Sheni in Kal Ades Yireim in Williamsburg, a.k.a. Wien, the Oberlander Kehila, and the post was Jonathan Steif. And that was not a Hasidic shul. But I have to ask you, Dan, this is old-time Hungarian Ashkenazi non-Hasidim. I have to ask you, where was the burial? The burial wasn't in Williamsburg. There's no cemetery in Williamsburg, or is there a cemetery in Williamsburg? Where is the cemetery? And if it's not in Williamsburg, did the family travel there? I don't see a heter for the family, or at least your Moshe doesn't assume there's a heter for traveling, even if a non-Jew drives you there. I don't see it. And Barry says, Rabbi Hartman, in New Bedford, the European Rav Hyman Lap Popkin permitted Levayos and Yom Tov Sheni because I saw it written on Matzevos, but after the 1940s, it stopped, but people could walk. So if you can walk from the shore to the cemetery, that's no issue. Although Rav Moshe says even in today's day and age, you shouldn't do it, even if you can walk, because it's not like the olden days where the only people who went to the funeral were the locals. He says that people from, and the Rav also held this, people from other cities, family members will drive. And you'll tell them you shouldn't drive. They'll say, well, no, I'm allowed to, I can drive because I'm not Shomer Shabbos. You're a Sabbath observant, so I understand, but I'm not Sabbath observant. So this is how I show respect.
That's the Rain cemeteries in New Jersey.
Yeah. So did your family go to it?
No.
Okay. So that's tough though, not being at the cemetery when they're buried. But that's interesting. So that the shul you're speaking about is a non-Hasidic, old-fashioned Chasam Sofer Hungarian minhag.
Exactly.
Yeah. So
Royers was the same way. No family went.
No family went. Yeah. So that's what my question was. That's interesting. Today it would be tough because people would. As I said, Rav Moshe feels that today, when we can keep the bodies from decaying, there's no real need for it, and it's not the Kavanah Meis. So, and Eli says the same thing. The Ekkes Shul does the same as Breuer's. I do know they're very machmir, and they did away with Yisker many years ago because so many people were driving the shul in the Chagim, especially Yom Kippur. By the way, since you mentioned Yisker, you should know that the Breuer's Shul does Yisker, but that's not the old Frankfurt Minhag. In Frankfurt, they never did Yisker. This is an American, you're shaking your head, Ruth, am I wrong here? This is an American practice that they started in Washington Heights, but in Frankfurt, they never did Yisker. It's not part of the traditional Yekki Minhag.
Once a month, they would read all the names of the people who died.
No, but I believe someone can correct me that in Washington Heights today they do Yisker.
They started doing it in Zurich too because so many people from outside. I didn't even remember that they would be saying Yisker. For 20 years I didn't say it.
Yeah, because it's not part. Thank you for confirming. They've changed because people feel they need to do it and other people are in it, but it's not part of the original German Minhag. Judah also says, my uncle as well buried on second day Yom Tov and Pesach. I don't know if it was a two-day Yom Tov or three-day. So Yonason Steif was a major posek. He was also an expert in Masorah, Masoretic matters. He published a Chumash with that.
My family.
Oops, sorry. He published although he made a very strange mistake. One of the early Masoretic works, like four volumes, that went early, 20th century, was by a man named Christian David Ginsburg, a Meshumet. But it's a vital work. It's an important work. It's a giant work. He also published an edition of Chumash. And anyone who works in Masorah has to do this. For some reason, Rabbi Steif, who wrote a lot about Masorah, published a Chumash, he thought that he saw on the book, the volumes, he must have seen Chaf Dalet Ginsburg. He didn't know that C.D. Ginsburg, that C.D. stands for Christian David. And he thought he was related to Louis Ginsburg. He wrote in the Ginsburg archives, his letter from Rav Steif to him is saying, he says, I'm assuming it's your father. Can you send it to me? But no. Christian David Ginsburg was a Jew who became a Meshumet in London, was involved in the London Society for the missionizing to the Jews. But it's an important work. If you understand Steif, I was at a wedding. The wedding I showed you the picture of last semester where I met Rabbi Yaakov Kapel Schwartz. And there's someone there who was sitting at my table who was hired by the family. They're putting out Rav Yonason Steif, not his responsa, that was already published, but his commentaries on the Talmud. And this person is hired. He's a big Talmud Chacham to edit it. And I think they've published a few of them. So there's a number of materials, number of books, a lot of them I was led to believe by Rabbi Yonason Steif, which is going to appear. Also, by the way, the Debreziner. The Debreziner Moshe Stern, that was not a Hasidic shul. It was the same old-fashioned Oberlander, Hungarian. And if you come, God willing, this summer, we shall return, I say, I hope. We shall return to Central Europe. You're all cordially invited. We will discuss all about the Chasam Sofer. We will go to his grave. We'll talk all about Hungarian Jewry, et cetera, et cetera. And we'll go to Sopron, which I just sent Rabbi Kelman, that they're redoing the synagogues in Sopron. So maybe it's been empty since the Holocaust. So maybe, and we'll see also the oldest synagogue in Europe, they say, the oldest synagogue in Hungary, not in Europe. It might be the oldest in Europe, in Sopron as well. Paul says the United Synagogue in England never heard a 48-hour delay for burial, now does as soon as possible. This is recorded in Taylor's book on Rabbi Hertz, Chief Rabbi Hertz. So I assume he has his facts correct. He's speaking about it earlier, in the lots of things were different then. So ossuary is these chests where they put the bones in. After the body decays over the year, they put it in, and that's they bury it. Thank you, Ellen, for clarifying that. I'm going down, so I don't see if people answer it before I get there. Ruth asks, does this waiting for some time to make sure someone is really dead have anything to do with Jesus' story about his resurrection? No, nothing to do with the Jesus story. I don't think Jews would be influenced by that. And Jews didn't believe in the resurrection story. But 3 days, it's interesting. 3 days, but I don't think so. And David says, I assume Kohanim may not enter these Jewish catacombs. No, absolutely. Well, no, absolutely not. They can't enter the Jewish catacombs. They cannot because there's still bones there. Rav Moshe says, Jeremy Kelman says, he's talking about this is a different shuva. This is part four, number 34. That's a different one. That perhaps there is no prohibition of osis go to do if one puts on tefillin in places where the minhag is not to. but the prohibition of do not change because it creates machlokes for sure applies and hence is prohibited. Ah, that's different than the later one I did. So that's what you're talking about. Very nice. So
by the way, it's interesting, if I may, and I have the index of the Yad Moshe, yeah, you know, all the tshuvas. So yeah, that's how I quickly found this tshuva that I guess I had remembered, but I couldn't find the tshuva that where he permits it, like where it says Tzulon Kol HaMoed. So you have to
send that's volume five.
I do want to look it up. I do want to see.
That's volume five, number 24, but I don't think the Yad Moshe has volume five.
That would explain why it's not in the Yad Moshe. Okay, but that's the one I remember, yes.
But Rabbi Hartman says that the Rav did not say a millionth, but the Rav's Rav Chaim's position was even pikuach nefesh to afford a reason you can be make. Yeah, but see, Rav Aaron used the word a millionth, and it just, I have to assume it's an exaggeration, because if you're going to go that far, then remember, we can't put our lives in danger either. So you're going to say you can't walk on the street because a car might hit you? Crazy things have happened. I don't know. Ruth says that the ancient practice of leaving the body in a catacomb or in a shelf for a year or so until the body disintegrates, only the bones are left and gathered up. Maybe what the Torah is alluding to in the phrase is that he will be gathered to his people when describing death and important characters. Yes, and I hadn't thought of that, but very nice. Mel tells us that Arnie Rothstein died of gunshot wounds, according to Wikipedia. Oh, so he was rubbed out, not Rabbi Hartman, the electric chair. Look, some of them got the electric chair. One of them, I forgot which Jewish gangster it was, that he was on, I think he was being kept in a hospital because he was injured on a high floor, and then he ends up being thrown out the window. Of course, the official report was he committed suicide. There's a guy at my university, University of Scranton, Joseph Krauss. He's into the Jewish mob. He recently published a book on Jewish mobsters, and there's a lot of books on Jewish mobsters. And someone privately emails me that I've known Irv Ruderman since we were at Columbia together 60 years ago. So you probably, the person emailed me, remembers the case. I heard it all from him because we sat together for, we both were working at this Pesach program, and we sat together. And someone says that Rothstein was shot while playing poker. Okay. These are people, I guess, we don't feel proud about them, but it's sort of, it's interesting, of course, that we've succeeded in many different ways. We could build Las Vegas and we could do all sorts of things. My grandmother remembers, she told me, what's his name? The big mobster, the one Israel sent out, wouldn't let it sent out.
Lansky,
Meyer Lansky. She remembered him walking his dog in Florida near where she lived. Rabbi Shudnow says he remembers Heschel speak out against Vietnam. Then JTS dropped the chaplaincy requirement for rabbinic students for ordination. Well, of course, Heschel is famous for that. But Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik also spoke out against Vietnam, and also Rabbi Lichtenstein. And Rabbi Hartman says that David Lukens, a Talmud of Rav Aaron, told me, yeah, you mentioned the thing about the debate that Atara between the brothers, but Atara opposed it. Rabbi Kalman says husband can travel with his wife to hospital on Shabbos. Yes, he can get in, he can get in the ambulance, even an ambulance, because we assume that giving birth is very traumatic, so he could definitely jump, get into the ambulance with it. And I was in a case when I worked at the hotel, Simcha by the Sea. I don't know if this is halachic, but a Rav did it. Again, it was happening at a difficult time, but someone was taken to the hospital, and well, I guess it would. He was near death, so the Rav said that the wife and the children could get in a car driven by a non-Jew and go to the hospital with them. If you can go with the wife, why couldn't you go if someone just had a heart attack, go there? We're not talking about just visiting. They thought that he could die. Sharon said, Marty, if you send a telegram to a tzaddik on Shabbos, how will he receive it? Well, because the telegram would come into the telegram, whatever it was, and they called it. It would come into the office, and then they would bring it. They'd bring it to the house, and then that's how these things used to work. David says sending a telegram at Shabbos is like,
I know, but then you have to receive it.
Yeah. So you bring it in. No, they knock on your door. They say Western Union or whatever it was in Poland. They bring it to you. And then that's not a problem. We get the mail delivered also. It's the same thing. And yes, telegrams are delivered by non-Jews most of the time. But I don't know if Reb Chaim, David's correct. It's Darabonan. But Reb Chaim, I think he would say even if it's Daraisa, you could. And Rabbi Shimon says, "Rabbi Tamar told us you could return home on Shabbos from bringing the cholo to the hospital." Yes, that's the standard halacha. That's hatzalah and doctors. Otherwise, we're afraid they wouldn't go, so we allow them to return home. But this isn't something recent. This is basic halacha. And iPad says that Arne Rothstein fictionalized kind of some of his life in the movie Funny Girl. I did not know that. Of course, if in The Godfather, you get Meyer Lansky. But there he's shot by the Italians, whereas we know that Meyer Lansky lived and died. He died in his bed, right? Okay. Someone remembers burials in Yom Tov Sheni. Ramosha says that Dr. Lyman finds some very persuasive clues to Eibschitz's closet Sabbateanism based on Eibschitz's wife's tombstone. Well, Schneer Lyman wrote an article called the Grave of Mrs. Eibschitz's Tombstone, something like that, A Grave Matter Indeed, punning on that. And what he shows in that is that Rav Yaakov Emden played fast and loose with the truth. If you look in Rav Yaakov Emden's Sefer, the way he lines up the letters to show Sabbatean hints, that's not what it looks like. And I have been to I've seen Mrs. Eibschitz's grave. Rav Yonasan, and he includes the pictures of it. Rav Yaakov Emden, he wasn't being frank. It's not really correct. He doesn't find clues there. I have to, Moshe, go back to the article. What he shows there is that Yaakov Emden finds clues, but the clues don't really, they don't line up because they don't measure up because he wasn't really correct in how he intentionally, I'm assuming, in what Rav Yaakov Emden did. Sometimes Rav Yaakov Emden, when he attacked Rav Yonasan Eibschitz, he was a little bit underhanded. Let's put it that way. Yeah. Quickly finish up with the rest. Okay. And my email, I'll post it right now for everyone, for the people who want to know. And then I will hand it over. The last thing, two more things that Danny says, Arno Rothstein got extensive treatment in TV series Boardwalk. Again, I never even heard of it. And I actually like mobster movies, but I don't. And finally, Bill says, Solomon Seitlin. We spoke about Solomon Seitlin last semester. In his review of the new Encyclopedia Judaica, he said it's a disgrace that there's entries on mobsters, Jewish mobsters, and they're lacking certain Jewish scholars. Well, you know something? At the end of the day, some of these Jewish mobsters are more significant to the world at large than some of these scholars. Bill says, this will be the last comment. In the telegram from Rav Chaim Heller to the Rav, sent on the first day of Yom Tov, I was told by Rabbi Rice that the Rav asked the telegram delivery man to open it. In other words, I don't know what you're referring to, but you're saying the Rav received the telegram on the first day of Yom Tov, and the Rav asked the telegram delivery man to open it. Well, we already have early sources that speak about mail being delivered, and you can ask the non-Jew. I think that's non-controversial at all, if it's not business stuff, to ask the non-Jew to open the mail for you on Shabbos. The truth is, although this is not the minhag, there's plenty of sources that say that you can even open up a letter and open up a package that you receive on Shabbos, because it's like opening up food packages. There are those shitas. The Mishnah Berurah says no, but there are people who hold that you can open up packages on Shabbos. Like, let's say you get a book delivered from Amazon on Shabbos. There are shitas that hold you can, for the same reason that we open food and things like that. And if once you open it, you can't reuse the box or anything like that. But we've taken long enough, I think. So Rabbi Kalman, take it away.
Okay, thank you. Yes, so as Mark alluded to before, Wednesday at 2 p.m., he will be interviewing Rafi El-Maleh from Morocco. He's quite a fascinating person. Anybody who goes to Morocco wants him to be your local tour guide. That I can assure you, they arrange a schedule to have him. He will, he led our tours when we were in Morocco along with Dr. Mark. So, Mark will be interviewing him Wednesday at 2 p.m., the first of a 5-part series. He's going to interview five people, 5 Wednesdays in a row, from Hungary and Italy.
And it's and to get Spain. A sense of what life is like for Jews in these countries. Correct. We're not asking you about tour guiding, although right. I'll mention that the first, but what it's like to be a Jew today in Morocco. And of course, there's been a lot. It's very different today than it was a year and a half ago with Israel and with the diplomatic relations. So lots happening.
Yeah, so you can register for that. That's Wednesday at 2. Wednesday at 11, Dr. Menachem Kellner will be giving beginning a three-part series on Rabbi Yehuda Levi and the Rambam, the distinction between Jew and Gentile, the debate between Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and the Rambam. And then tomorrow at 9:30 a.m., Dr. Aaron Kohler will be starting a six-part series on Megillat Esther. Note the time, 9:30 a.m. That's because next Tuesday, Rachel Danziger-Sharansky will be starting her series, a 10-part series, at 11 a.m. So that's going to be 9:30, 11, and then regular Tuesday, Alex Israel's at 1 p.m. So that's going to be three sort of back-to-back-to-back. And then all our regular classes Thursday, Marco Simkowitz and Shuli Mishkin, and then the Parsha Shir this week is given by Leah Sarna. And then my seer on the sitter at 9 a.m. on Friday morning. Wednesday night, Dr. Sokolo, 8 o'clock, the putting together of Tanakh. He's going through now the Parshanim. We're in Provence last week going through the Parshanim on Tanakh. Very interesting. That's 8 p.m. on Wednesday night. I think that covered most of the classes for this week. So we look forward to learning with you, and join us, and invite a friend to come. There's so many classes. No matter how much your friend does or doesn't like you, there's got to be something they're going to like. So give them the choice, and we look forward to seeing you. And thank you very much. And
Excuse me, everybody.
Yeah.
Mark says he was going to post his email address, but I don't see it in the chat.
He didn't post it. Okay, so I can post. I think he. I don't know if I. The one he likes to post. Well, you know, I don't want to do it for him. Where I'm very. Mockbeat here on privacy. I'm pretty sure he posts his Scranton one, yeah. But if you'll, that's when he posts, right? Because I necessarily, right. Okay. I never use that one. If somebody has it, send me an email. I'll forward it to Mark if you want to get in contact with him. Yeah. I think he left already, but, yeah, he's very good. He doesn't mind, but still normally we never publish any speakers' email addresses. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Laila
Tov. Thank you. Laila Tov. Thanks. Okay, we'll see you soon. Please God. Okay, everybody, be well.